Hello out there. This is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial unless your FM was made in America.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where typically we interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today in the Zoom is David Fisher from Sacramento. Hey, David.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So would you start by just telling us about your background and experience as an educator?
Right. So I have taught mostly second grade since about 1997. And prior to that, I was a substitute teacher in the Oakland and Hayward area. I moved up to Sacramento and finished my credential and taught at a school called Clayton B. Wire Elementary for probably about 19 years at that particular school. And our district, unfortunately, a few years ago, like some districts do, began to close schools, per usual in the areas that are the most vulnerable. They ended up closing my school, and that sort of led me to be more active. And I ran for office, and here I am now. So that's a brief synopsis.
Yeah. And when you think back, what inspired you? We always like to ask our guests what inspired them to become educators.
Right. Well, good question. So I didn't originally go to college to be an educator. I had a philosophy and business background, which is kind of an interesting combination. Like a lot of people in their early 20s did different things, and I ended up getting into school photography. I worked for a company called Life Touch Photography. And So we had lots of contact with schools. And I decided to, give that a shot, became a substitute teacher for a while, even before I started my credential program, and make sure it was something I wanted to do. After doing that for about a year, I went ahead and got my credential and, been a public school teacher ever since.
Got it. And now you're the president of your local, of Sacramento City Teachers Association.
Right.
So tell us about that journey, how you ended up going from taking photos to becoming the president of your local.
Right. So I had already mentioned that we had this event that was actually kind of traumatizing when they closed our school. So I had become involved with the union, became the local site rep. Sometimes they're called shop stewards at my school, and was involved in that and was part of the bargaining team off and on for many years. And so I was involved, yet not as an officer, and people had encouraged me to run, several times, but I had this commitment to my school and my community. I had brought my own daughter into my elementary school when she was in the first grade, and she was actually in my class in the second grade when our school district decided to close our school and six other schools in some of the most vulnerable areas, supposedly to for budget considerations. But as we know, none of the schools in the more affluent neighborhoods got closed, and there were many schools with actually lower enrollment than ours. So that event, you know, we had a broad coalition against the schools, but you know, at the time, to be honest, I didn't really think our union stood up enough. I mean, they were against it, but I didn't feel like, you know, it was robust enough. So that sort of inspired me. And then as my school year was ending and it was obvious we were losing the battle, one of my good friends and colleagues who at the time was vice president said, well, we've asked you to run before, now your school is closing, you're gonna have to move schools anyway, what about now? And so I just took that moment to go ahead and run for at the time for vice president. And then since then I've also run for president. So that's how I ended up where I am.
Gotcha. And I'm just curious, was it a contested race for president?
No, not this last time, it was not. The first time I ran actually for vice president, it was contested. And so this one was not.
Yeah, okay. I feel like we need to have more contested races in our unions. Sometimes we don't have those.
Right, we want to have as much involvement as possible.
Yeah, and also just how many members in your local?
We represent around 2,300 regular certificated employees, and we also represent the substitutes, which in California is unusual. I think there's only about 7 districts or locals in the entire state. So if you add all the list of substitutes in, we represent about 2,800 certificated educators.
Awesome. Well, we wanted to have you on the show more than a month ago when you just wrapped up your strike, but obviously you had so much going on then. But let's go back, and can you start by telling us what led up to your strike?
Right. Yeah, so we had been without a contract since 2019, actually. And so we've been negotiating for some time. The district has been demanding huge takeaways in almost every area you can imagine, but specifically in health benefits, they have been demanding that teachers contribute an average of about $10,000 per year more than they contributed. And for some teachers, especially those with families, it would be close to $20,000. So that was, you know, major, you know, motivation, you know, for us. Lots of details about how our district had continually misinformed the community about its economic status. We were about to go into state takeover at one point, they said, about to be bankrupt. And every year they said it, they would actually run a surplus to the point where, you know, they are pretty close to having to currently pay down their reserve fund, because in California there's a law that you can only have a 10% reserve fund. They built up a 70% reserve fund. So all that frustration building through the pandemic, right? So we were online during all that for a year, and then back in person and modified for a few months, and then back completely in person. But as most people experienced, you know, with the surge in the coronavirus, we had also, you know, many safety issues. So we were actually in negotiations over safety, COVID safety measures, and we were able to win, among many other things, good filtration systems and, you know, science-based, you know, HEPA filters, things like that. Mm-hmm. However, trying to make a long story short, we were in negotiations simultaneously over a successor contract and the COVID issues, and our vacancy rates prior to the pandemic were extremely high. But what, of course, we saw with our substitutes and even regular teachers of record is huge vacancy rates, and kids were being corralled into cafeterias, you know, sometimes for 4 or 5 hours at a time with maybe one substitute teacher, several hundred teachers. We had almost 600 students who, and before the strike, hadn't even had a day of instruction because the district wouldn't and couldn't staff the independent study program. So all this led to a precipice around the COVID-related issues, where we went to impasse on that. And you know, I'm not sure how it is in Oregon, but in California, you go through impasse mediation, something called fact-finding. We actually went through that, not on the successor contract, but on the COVID-related staffing that we ended up officially going on strike about. But through the fact-finding and through the whole process, we ended up getting you know, significant improvements to our contract, and our contract extended. So that's kind of a synopsis summary, but of course, lots of other details.
So you mentioned that you were working on both the COVID safety and the successor contract. What were some specific primary issues that you were working on besides the insurance? What were some other things that you were working on?
Right, so on the successor contract side, you know, they had the huge take back on the table. They also had a 5-year wage freeze. Meanwhile, they were giving the superintendent huge raises, even though we had done a vote of no confidence along with our classified brothers and sisters. And, you know, they were demanding things like unlimited workday, decrease, and believe this, decrease in recess time and lunchtime. and our members in our community were pretty outraged about that. And among the issues with the COVID related, we were working on extra pay for our substitutes, working on ways to staff classrooms when there was a vacancy, like combining classes, you know, extra pay or other extra motivation incentives to cover classrooms. There were all the safety issues that we were working on, and you know, our school nurses were working, being told they had to do all this extra work on contact tracing and things like that. So we had proposals around how to help compensate for that. And so, you know, I've got a list here that I can take you through your whole time and going through. I don't want to do that, but there were a lot of things on the table, and our district was just completely intransigent in every area. And so we just reached a point that, you know, we had to, you know, take that you know, final step towards a strike.
So SCTA, your local, was working with SEIU, which represents your classified staff.
Right.
How was that working with your union siblings from another union?
Well, I'll tell you, it was great. Our history, we haven't always at the leadership level, you know, before my time and then when I first started, been necessarily on the same page. You know, you can be in your silos. It's, but at the site level, you know, the camaraderie among the members, you know, between our classified brothers and sisters and the certificated has always been pretty good. You know, the classified, they run the schools. They get the kids to the school on their bus. They open the school. They clean the school. They, you know, answer the phones and a lot more, right? And so it just seemed like, and they were experiencing the same kind of challenges among staffing and the same kind of, you know, arbitrary and punitive demands for or takeaways. And they had, you know, their 6-hour employees were being reduced to 3 hours just to get rid of their benefits. So they had their other issues too. And it just made sense to us to work together. And although we, you know, legally are on separate unions and separate paths, we ended up, you know, having our strike simultaneous with the SEIU unit.
And just out of curiosity, like here in Portland, we're having a major issue with hiring for custodial positions in particular. What's that like in Sacramento?
Yeah, well, it's probably similar, and not just custodial. We had issues with bus drivers, kids not being able to even get to school, or teachers having to drive them home. So for, you can go through the day from trying to get kids to school to the end of the day trying to clean the schools. There's just a complete lack of staffing. And our district, what we found was unique is that while staffing issues are, you know, pretty common statewide and nationwide, our district was actively making it worse by these huge demands, just driving people away. Nobody wanted to apply for our district, and so we had issues with the custodians. We had our special education department with the aides, constant people would come in for you know, get hired and stay for a few weeks and then realize the conditions and the pay were, you know, so poor they would leave. So just about on every level we were experiencing what other districts are experiencing, and at the same time having management seemingly determined to make it worse than it needed to be.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do to prepare for the possibility of a strike? What sort of tactics did you try previous to your strike vote?
Yeah, well, good question. So we, you know, we said the best way to avoid a strike is to be prepared for a strike. So, you know, for years now, we, even pre-pandemic, you know, we've been we've transitioned from a more service model union to an organizing model. So starting with just making sure that you're solid at each site, and starting with by running petitions so you can actually kind of see where are people engaged, where are they not engaged, and slowly ratcheting up the asks, basically. First can sign a petition, and then we have a rally, and being very intentional about it. Trying to be professional around the organizing, not just say, hey, let's do this great thing, everyone show up, let's have the event, or and then let's track it. If we had issues with certain sites, or we would make sure that we would pay special attention there. Mm-hmm. And we tried to track and be, like I said, professional. The other thing was, during the pandemic, it became more challenging, but we continued our practices of doing quote site visits, but we did them by Zoom, and actually found a lot of new leaders that just weren't able to make some of the meetings because of either childcare or other issues through Zoom. So, kind of a long answer to your question. We just started slow by, moving petition, ratcheting it up for school board meetings to rallies, and making sure we were ready when the time came.
Great. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. So, David, you talked about some of the actions, sort of ratcheting up the pressure. How was the decision to take a strike vote made? So at some point you decided, okay, we've
right.
gotten to the point where it's time for a strike vote. How did that happen?
Right, so we were in the process called fact-finding here in California, where it means that you've already been through impasse, the state has already assigned a mediator. And when you went into fact-finding, and it's really a misnomer, the finding of facts, there's a third party that neutral that sort of listens to both sides and comes out with a recommendation. So our strategy was to have a strike vote in our pocket even prior to that recommendation. So what we did is we did rounds of visits to the sites to make sure everybody was educated on the issues. And then our bargaining team and executive board authorized a strike vote even prior to setting a date, and prior to even knowing what the recommendations were gonna be and what the district was gonna do, as sort of a strategy to try to, try to get a settlement without a strike. We didn't set a date when we first did that. We just did the strike vote, and we ended up getting a 98% yes. So we had that, basically in our pocket when the fact finder's report came out. And when it came out, the recommendations were largely in our favor, which was of course helpful. At that point we held a huge rally at our district's headquarters. We had thousands of members come up, and then we announced the strike date on that date for a week later than that date, giving the district at the time what we thought was plenty of time for them to get serious. But that was our process and our timing of it.
Gotcha. And do you recall sort of what the wording was of that motion to go on strike?
I have it right here. We had several paragraphs just explaining what the issues were prior to the actual ballot language, but it read, do you authorize the bargaining team and executive board to call a strike if the district continues to bargain in bad faith and or insist on unacceptable demands to address the staffing crisis and COVID-related health and safety standards? So the strike vote was actually, because the impasse that we were in was technically around the bargaining for the COVID-related and safety standards. So we worded it in that way.
Gotcha, great. And so it sounds like then a week later you went on strike. Mm-hmm. Talk about the kinds of things that your members did during that time that you were on strike. And how long were you on strike for?
Yeah, so we ended up being on strike for 8 school days, 12 calendar days. It was quite the blur. Actually, I had to, after the strike, go back and even write down what we did every day. You know how it is when you're in it. But we had incredible support. First day and then every day we'd start with picket lines at the sites. So, you know, half hour before when the school was supposed to open, all our members would be on their picket lines at the sites. We had different themes for different days, but the first day we met up at the district headquarters and had a huge rally. We one of the rallies at the County Office of Education, because there's a whole backstory to that and how they were being, really unhelpful. We had a great rally down at City Hall that got a lot of press coverage. We ended up getting a really incredible picture from our local newspaper and from a drone. That was something else. And then I think the fourth day, where it was pouring rain, and we had Dolores Huerta that was coming, and we were doing this at a high school that had not good parking. And that was the first time I had a little bit of doubt. You know, I was like, okay, how's this going to be? And it was incredible. Our support of our own members just continued to grow. And, you know, we had the saying, we didn't invent it, but we, as the days were going on, you know, one day longer, one day stronger. Mm-hmm. And we really saw that was not just a slogan. People were, as the strike went on, you know, even though we all had a little bit of doubts what would happen the next day, we just kept getting, stronger and more support in the community day by day. And we ended up going through 8 days, and the last 3 days of the strike, we concentrated under district headquarters, ended up taking our bargaining team, sort of taking over one of the district buildings and ensconcing ourselves until they were willing to bargain with us.
Wow.
Yeah, that was fun. I mean, by the way, you asked what we did. So it was the atmosphere on the strike line. So I would go around to the different schools was really high energy. And if our district had a strategy, it was number one, they thought that the parents would be against us. And number two, they thought they could outlast us. And they both backfired. At the sites, parents were bringing food and, walking with their teachers. And then, at the rallies, we'd have these spontaneous, like, line dancing things going on, and people brought their own, what's that called? Like a drum group, like elementary, one school brought their elementary drum group. We had people who were, professional DJs that remember that would set up, and it was this really kind of like festive atmosphere, even though none of us wanted to be there. And then what we saw with the community support when we went into the district office, that data sort of basically just set up camp until they actually broke in good faith. We had a couple parents that came in with us, and we asked if we could help them, and they said, "Where's the superintendent's office?" So we showed them, and they called their friends. They ended up at one point having over 40 community members, children, parents that camped out for 5 days in the district office in front of the superintendent's office. So that's how. One example of how the community support really, really came through.
I love that. I'm writing down all these ideas right now. So what did the district do to pressure you to end the strike?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, if they had a strategy, it was one, to try to rile up the parents against us, and then to wait us out. So prior to the actual strike, once we had set a date, they sent out a series of really inflammatory emails to our community, using words how unconscionable, how the SCTA leadership, and like is the tried and true technique of trying to separate leadership from the members, and it really backfired. We had dozens of unsolicited emails from family members, community members, saying, "This is, baloney." Well, they didn't use that word. "You guys should get your chance. Why are they treating the teachers so poorly?" So that really backfired. And then, they could just wait us out. But around day six, and when we actually were getting stronger on the line, the community was coming at more support. Every day, more community members were actually going into camp out in front of the superintendent's office, And, you know, the behind the scenes, a lot of phone calls were being made from influential people in our community, politicians, basically to our school board. And they, I think they finally realized, you know, this isn't working and we look terrible. And so they finally began bargaining good faith around day six. And then it only took a couple of days to get it done.
Yeah. So how did that end come about? Like how did that, those final days of negotiations go?
Yeah. So, I want to say it was on a Friday. They finally started to actually bring decision makers to the table and you know, meet with us. Before, they were just sending a lawyer and a consultant and showing up 6 hours late or just changing the data on the proposal, really not just surface bargaining, not doing any real problem solving or movement. And then as they started to feel the pressure, it was like there was no movement, or even their tactics were like, we're going to go on a 15-minute caucus, and they'd be gone for 6 hours, you know, that kind of stuff. But the community saw this as one of the things. We just publicized all that. We even set up a meeting with our state superintendent of public instruction, and they just didn't show up to it. So the community was seeing districts AWOL. They were getting tons of pressure. About day six, they made a lot of movement, and then it was really just a matter of working out the last few details over that weekend. That weekend, they wanted to, get the family members and the teachers out of the district offices. So we ended up having to camp out ourselves, at least some of us did, to keep the doors open and make sure our parents and families could get in and out. And we kind of took over. There's like a patio area with lots of grass, and it turned into like almost like a festival. We had families coming, bringing snacks or bringing balloons and blowing bubbles with the kids. It came quite an event. And I think all that kind of just led the district to believe that, that, you know, they had lost. What I had said stopped me from rambling a little bit, but about day two or day three, when the support was really moving in our favor, I felt like the district had lost. And they just needed to go through the stages of grief, so to speak, you know, kind of like the denial, acceptance, and all that. And that's how I would sort of describe what they did.
Well, in our last couple of minutes, do you think you could sort of share how this experience impacted you, your union, and your community as a whole?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, during the whole strike, and as you know, we weren't sure of the outcome until the last couple of days. You know, there wasn't getting a lot of movement. But speaking of the word movement, we communicate with our members and even with our community that, you know, this is a contract campaign. There's going to be a settlement eventually, but this is a movement. We felt like that it was like this giant team building exercise for our own members, site by site and district wide, and in addition to the community. You really saw, you know, a lot of support. We even had city council members and county supervisors who hadn't really been involved. They actually joined our bargaining team and so, sat with us for hours and hours and hours. So to kind of summarize, we didn't know going into exactly, you know, how it's going to turn out. But once we got the settlement and got on the other side of it, it turned out to be a very positive experience, and we're looking to keep the momentum going, you know, through our school board elections, and keep the along with the support of the community to really make this about a movement as opposed to like a you know, one-time event.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, David, for joining us tonight and sharing your experience.
Yeah, thanks, David.
And thank you to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a Radio Ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. to catch another Labor Radio show.